All right, it is Shabbat. What's the date today?
Today should be the
22nd of November. 22nd. Here at Mark.
Yes, 22.
That's 22 right there. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so welcome this morning.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you. It's a blustery day. Who's that? Is that mine? Is that yours?
Before?
Phone in there. Maybe your phone. Do you have a cell phone that was pressed against me?
I've never heard that. Sorry.
Well, today we have a small group. I've been mulling around ideas in my head recently, and one story that keeps coming back is Luke 16. So we're going to look at Luke 16, the shrewd manager. And I'm going to start with some prayer, and we'll dig into it. Lord, thank you for this Shabbat. Thank you for bringing each one here and any who are on their way. And we pray we could learn something today and be inspired how we can apply it to our life, how we can be wise with what you've given us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Did you say Luke 16?
I said Luke 16.
Okay.
We're going to read it together. And actually, I'm going to give you a big picture look at it. My dad wrote an article. My dad, for those who are listening or don't know my background, is Randall Booth. He wrote an article in the Jerusalem Perspective, either in 87 or 91. I forget which year. If you check 87 issues or 91, or just ask him, you can get some of the details behind what I'm going to talk about. First of all, what versions do we have out there? What are you reading from?
Hebrew names.
Hebrew what?
Hebrew names.
Hebrew names, okay.
American Standard. NIV.
American Standard, NIV. Does yours have titles to chapters?
The Parable of the Shrewd Manager.
Shrewd Manager, right. Okay, that's NIV. That's nice. What does yours say? Does yours have a title?
It says the Unrighteous Steward.
The Unrighteous Steward. Okay. This is a parable that Jesus taught. And like most parables, it has a surprise to it. And it's a bit baffling to some people as you're reading it. Because what is going on? So we're going to read through it to make sure we have refreshed our memories before we start talking the details. And as people walk in, I'm just going to write the rest. Luke 16. Parable of the shrewd manager. Or unjust steward. Anyone have anything else?
Unrighteous.
Oh, yours says unrighteous?
Unrighteous, yeah.
Okay.
That's what it said anyway.
Unrighteous.
They're pretty close, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean,
unjust, unrighteous. Not quite honest, I suppose.
Yeah. Welcome. And what Bible translation are you reading from?
This one, which is the, I believe this is the new,
okay.
King James Version, I believe it is.
New King James.
Although I have another one in my pocket that I can use any version that you prefer.
Oh, no, I have no preference. I was just simply curious what your Luke 16, the title to the parable, what it's called it.
Okay, Luke 16.
Mm-hmm.
Luke. Luke 16. He also said to his disciples.
Does it have a title, a subtitle or not?
No, it does not.
No. Okay. Well, some people don't like to bias you before you read it, which is also a good thing. So let's go ahead and read it. I have, who would like to read for us?
I'll read first. Okay. I can read it. Mm-hmm. All through here. Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. Should have joined the union. I'm not strong enough to be ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. So he called in each of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourself, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with little, with very little, can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money.
All right. So you read both the parable and two little sayings that have been attached to it here. Only one of these comes somewhere else. The no servant can serve two masters also appears in Matthew. But the rest we only have in Luke. As many other wonderful parables, like the prodigal son, it's only in Luke. Do you, when you read this parable, do you find it surprising in any way?
Yeah, I find it surprising that he would commend him for doing something that I would consider to be dishonest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It begins, this is the bad man, this is the bad man, this is the bad man.
Yeah.
You don't understand.
Well, let's discuss, what do you think he's done that's dishonest?
Well, if these people owe his master that much money, or that much those mm-hmm. products that he was talking about, oil and grain, and, mm-hmm. and he told them, you know, here, we're paying that, you know, half as much, basically.
Right. So it seems...
what you really owe.
Yeah, right, right.
So he was making friends with these people, so...
Mm-hmm. But it seems like he has deprived his master,
right? He robbed his master, is kind of how I look at it.
Right.
Well, it could be that that really the charge should have been 400 gallons in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And the unrighteous steward had put the other in his pocket.
Well, this is a question when the story starts out just telling us that there are accusations that he had been squandering his master's assets. So you could ask yourself, how would a manager squander those assets? What exactly had he been doing wrong?
He wasn't just wasting, he was manipulating something, right?
Well, wasting is one.
He was
scattering it.
Yes, that's what I thought of too.
He squandered it. He did the same thing as a prodigal son. Is there a difference between, he scattered it, yeah. If you're reading the Greek word, he scattered it around. He just, that sense of wasting it. I mean, is squander any different than waste, except it has this connotation of broadly, indiscriminately wasting?
I ask you a question. What is the main purpose of this rich man to doubt his agent, let's say agent? He has no material proof of...
Right.
that too.
You know, what is the, you know, real reason?
Apparently the accusations were coming from a trustworthy enough source that he fired this manager.
He just heard.
You're right, he did just hear.
But doesn't indicate any specific reason.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, based on evidence or proof.
It doesn't tell us. And there are many questions you have of a parable that you wish you could go back and ask more, but parables are concise stories.
Up there is the quandary. Are we talking about a shrewd manager or an unjust steward?
Okay.
And like I said, when you end, the statement is, you really don't understand.
Right. Well, both words are used. If you look down in verse 8, towards the end of the story, the master commended the dishonest manager. That word for dishonest, it actually says the manager of unrighteousness or of unjustness.
Say it's First John.
So I'm not sure I would say dishonest, but maybe unjust. Or you could say unrighteous in the sense that he hadn't been completely righteous.
Questionable means.
And he commended him, though, because he acted shrewdly.
And here's what else we don't know. When he said, your bill is 800 gallons, maybe the master had told him, charge him for 800.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells him, no, you really owe 400.
Right.
Maybe the manager was the real unjust one.
Right.
I don't know.
Well.
No, I mean, maybe the master was the real unjust one. We don't know.
So, by the way, the word for shrewd there is phronimos, it's wise. It's to act wisely. It's to do something that's smart. It's a good decision. So, whatever this servant has done, the master sees that it's a smart move. And he doesn't condemn him even more, like, look, this is exactly what I'm talking about, how unjust you are. He actually says, that was a good call. So, you were going to say something?
Yeah, possibly it's the type of transaction that goes on, as mentioned in the Psalms, where an individual goes to the particular location to purchase. It seems like it's something like an old city purchase.
Mm-hmm.
And when the individual goes there, he's saying, this is so terrible, this what you're doing, it's just really bad what you're charging me, and so forth and so on. So it goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of it, he leaves with having purchased. And then instead of stating that he had made a very bad purchase, as he had mentioned to the proprietor, he starts bragging.
Right.
What a great deal.
Well, that is quoted in another parable. That's true. There's that tendency.
So possibly these particular amounts are those types of amounts, whereas they put it up to 100% and charge you 100%. And these amounts are not actually solid.
Mm-hmm.
They are amounts that are being presented,
right,
but they're not necessarily the actual cost or the revenue that is actually needed.
Well, this is where I think cultural background comes in. We have things like, think about it, when you're going to get a loan, what happens? Do you just say, hey, I need $5,000, and the person gives you $5,000, and then you repay $5,000 5 years later?
Not very often.
No. What do you repay 5 years later?
A little bit more than $5,000.
How much more?
Depends.
It depends. It depends how you borrowed it, what things were set up. And, I mean, we have credit cards where, you know, you can end up paying 30% interest if you haven't paid by a certain time. There's all kinds of things that go on in our culture that we understand. And in Jesus' day, the neat thing is we have some papyri that show business transactions. And the thing I'm missing for you this morning is the exact source. Like, you can go read the papyri if you read Greek. And those will be found in the article I quoted by Randall Booth, who will be here shortly in a couple weeks. You can just come back and talk to him. But the nice thing is, in these papyri, as I remember, you have the same ratios. So you mentioned maybe you only owed 400.
Mm-hmm.
The same ratios of
liquid
of a 50% interest / tax / commission. What I'm not sure is how much, let's say, okay, we take the 400. And so the 50%, I don't know how much of this might have gone to the steward, but certainly the steward would have gotten some of that. That would have been his commission. So let's say, usually most people lending money, they do so for a reason. It's beneficial to them. So they're getting an interest. They're getting some profit from it. And so let's say the owner gets some of this, but maybe the steward, maybe his salary came mostly from this commission.
Where's the 400 at, interest?
Well, he says what, he sits down with the debtors and say, what do you owe?
Right.
Oh, yeah, actually, what version you reading from NIV? NIV translated.
Where, what verse?
The verse is,
Six.
100 measures of olive oil.
Right.
And the measure is a bath. And a bath is 8 gallons, or about 30 liters. And so that would be about 875 gallons.
Mine says 900.
Yours says 900.
That's closer, I suppose, to 875.
But it's 100 baths.
It's 100 baths, yeah.
To 50 baths.
Right, and what did you say, 400 what? It was started with 800, or was that the wheat we're remembering?
That's the next one.
That's the oil. The wheat is, it says 1,000 bushels. Right. To 800.
So it was the wheat, 100 measures of wheat. If a kor is the dry measure they're using, it was about 10 to 12 bushels, which is 390 meters. And, liters, sorry. Liters. And it represented the yield of about 100 acres.
You're talking about the wheat.
The wheat.
Because it says 100 cores here,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But then what does he say, give me?
They both have 100 measures. The first one is 100 measures. Yeah, let's just go back to what the parable says. Use their numbers.
100 to 50.
100 to 50, right?
Yeah, 100 to...
80.
80.
100 oil.
Okay, let's presume this. So 100...
oil.
Is debt for the oil. And
80 plus 20.
And 100 is a debt for the wheat. And we're figuring this out based on what he's cutting off. He's like, just make your debt this. So instead of 100, make it 50. Instead of 100 for wheat, make it 80. And these ratios actually represent, in the papyri, the established taxes or commissions.
For those products.
For those products, exactly. Just like today in Israel, if you buy a car, how much tax do you pay?
110%, I heard.
Yeah, is it?
Yeah.
118
plus
VAT. 118, okay,
100
plus
VAT. Even more.
Plus value-added tax, which is 18%, though.
Yeah, whatever.
17-18%, so that part varies, but 118%. And therefore, your $10,000 car now becomes $20-something thousand dollars. And then subsequent, when you go to sell that car after your initial purchase, your next buyer is going to pay that price, too, because the first buyer had to pay it. So there's this huge amount of tax in there. And so, based on the papyri, we see that for oil, it was being 50% more was being added on. And for wheat, 20% more was added on. So those ratios we see in the business world at the time. And I think that, like you were asking the questions already, that completely adds to our understanding of this story in Luke 16. Because it's not like the original debt, he just owed 100 straight up, and now he's, so to speak, giving away 50 of his master's money. He's giving away his commission. Or potentially there is a little bit of interest for his master that he would be giving away. But it's mostly his commission. And that's why the owner could look at that and say, well, that's a smart move. Because, and you could say, is it a smart move? If you were a steward and always gave away all of your commission, you wouldn't have a salary, would you? So, in a sense, if you're looking at it as a long-term strategy, it's not totally smart. But it is smart when you're looking at it in its context, because his manager is about to fire him. And so, what is he thinking? Why is he giving up his commission?
Because it's not his anymore.
He's hoping to win friends.
Not only is it not his, he's hoping to win friends.
Well, he can get another job. Once he's fired, these guys might hire him.
They might hire him. It's more important to him to make friends than to worry about his own salary. He can do without a couple months' salary if he can secure the trust and friendship of other people.
Get another job.
And get another job. So it's smart.
So they feel obligated. I mean, I don't quite understand. It must be a cultural thing. I mean, in today's culture, I don't think in the United States that anybody would feel obligated to help the guy out later on just because they gave him a good deal once. Mm-hmm. Somewhere down the line, I mean, you know, like,
yes,
hey,
and no.
Can I camp out on your couch?
Yes and no. It depends how good the deal was, first of all.
That's a really good deal.
And some people feel more obliged than others, naturally. But I would say in this culture there is that sense of obligation. But let's say like a family member had given you a large sum of money. You wouldn't turn around and
right.
do something mean to them. There is that in the back of your mind, you're thinking, wait, you know, they've really helped me out. I need to extend a little more.
Again, it reminds me of another psalm. Mm-hmm. Which says that a man that is wealthy and he gives to people, then they are going to love him. But a man that is poor, when he comes back, they don't want to deal with him because he's always taking them. So mm-hmm. the one that is wealthy is the one that is giving away, and he's going to create friends.
Mm-hmm.
So he has many friends, and the poor man has no friends. So this man, even though he's about to be poor, is doing something very shrewd, causing people to think highly of him, even though he's been a bad person, possibly, in the light of these being fired for inappropriate activities. He's mm-hmm. turning it around, and the owner is saying, hey, that's pretty smart.
Yeah,
he's a good marketer.
I think in his last business deals, something has changed. He has done something differently in all the former. When the former, he seems to be very interested in his own commission. And who knows that he didn't even put it up a little higher, or that he might have taken more. Or I was thinking back to this initial question, how did he squander the money? And I was thinking about, if you come from America, or now anywhere in the world, you may have heard of subprime loans. Was he giving loans from his master's stuff to people he knew couldn't pay back so that he could charge more and more interest? This type of thinking is greedy. It's very selfish. Like, I can get more out of it from that person.
Or were his scales off?
Were scales off?
Intentionally.
We're not told. It must not be the... It's a good question, though.
Huh. Yeah. It doesn't tell us exactly how he was. But you do see a dramatic shift, because he says, there's a crisis. I'm going to lose my job. It changes his whole paradigm on life.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been secure up to that point. He's had his salary. He's been in charge of the whole household goods. So this is not some lowly servant working in a field. This is like the Joseph. This is the person in charge. Basically, he's the economist of the household. He's the, what do you call it? The person in charge of the piggy bank of the house.
Manager.
Manager
of the business.
So he's the educated class. As he said, I'm not strong enough to dig. Like, what would I do? Could I even survive as a field worker? No.
He has no calluses on his hands.
Like, yeah, he's panicking. He has that long pinky finger fingernail. You've seen that before?
Explain it, Shen.
Some cultures, for managerial positions, the men especially, I don't know about the women, but you notice on the men, they grow their pinky fingernail long. And it's a symbol that they don't do manual labor. Because, you know, they're sitting doing Indians, some Arabs, some different nationalities will have the same kind of symbol of, I'm not a manual labor person. So I have a long fingernail.
Just one hand, right, I think? Or
Yeah,
usually one. And it's true. I mean, have you ever grown your fingernails long?
Can't do
it. It's very hard just to do things like opening a can, digging a ditch, watering. Anyway, so he knows this crisis is, I know I cannot do that kind of work. What are my options? Like, this is the only thing I'm trained for. And if I lose my job and my reputation, what are my chances of survival? I'm going to end up begging those same people that I used to be charging commission. Now I'm going to have to go beg from them, and I'm too ashamed to do that. So he has this epiphany and this paradigm shift.
There is another question that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. What about those debtors? Is there any honest one from them that he won't accept the proposal of the agent, you know? And in fact, the owner, when he want to kick one out from his business, he usually appoint an auditor or accountant, or he himself will take over from this terminated agent.
Maybe. But let's say, if we presume the cultural background of this, that there is a 50% commission, when the owner sees the numbers, that will all be straightforward to him. There's no... That part isn't the dishonesty. It's... It might be more nuanced. For instance, how much of that 50%... Like, the fact that the 50% is added on is normal. How much of the 50% should go to the steward and how much to the owner and interest? I don't know. Maybe he was playing with the numbers there.
There is a specific thing, 100...
Right, the specific 100, ratio is what we have in the papyrus.
It's not interest or it's not commission or
it's not
anything.
Stated that way,
it's
you're right.
It's a material thing, 100...
we're dealing with material. We're not dealing with money, but money, material represents money. Money represents material. For instance, in the net notes, there, when they were discussing this, the measure for the baths of oil, they say this is about 875 gallons or 3,000 liters of olive oil. So picture that, 3,000 liters of olive oil worth 1,000 denarii, which is over 3 years' pay for a daily worker. Now, granted, a daily worker is going to be on the low, that's minimum wage, but still, 3 years' worth for a minimum wage person to get this kind of money. So when you're talking about feeling obligation, I think this, if someone were to waive three years' worth of your salary, meaning that you could pay back this debt 3 years sooner and half the time, I think that puts in perspective how much you would feel you would owe that person. It's not just that they're, hey, I'll give you the $100 you need to cover this debt. This is a great, great help. And in some cases, like today, if you can pay it back earlier, it means you pay less. It means that the interest doesn't keep going up and you're forever being bound by this debt. So it would be a huge relief. And I think that's why everyone who is in debt is very glad to take the offer. They see how much this person is saving them in terms of time and their basic resources, or the amount of time it would take them to get those resources has been halved, which may in some cases actually make it doable for them, where if it remained as high as it was, maybe they would be in debt their whole life. So he has gained friends that way, and if it's a significant debt like that, the chances of them feeling obligated or wanting to express their gratitude to him afterward are quite high. You know, the more you receive, the more thankful you are, or the more appreciative when you realize how much it is. Talking about what?
Chapter
16 of Luke.
Verse 9.
Yes. Make friends for yourselves by how you use worldly wealth. And the other interesting thing in verse 9, it says, make friends from wealth of unrighteousness. And we've all translated it worldly wealth. So we've glossed over that connection, because that's the same word they use to describe the steward, the unjust steward.
Or if you translate it secular wealth.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you should be unjust, and then you can eternal.
Well, that's a problem with how you understand the word unjust. Because let's assume that this is the cultural background. These are interest rates. Nobody would blame an accountant today for charging interest or taking the interest.
But nobody likes paying interest.
But nobody likes it either, that's true.
Yeah, but when they say about eternal profits,
Well, now it's moving from one sphere to another. But if the point is comparing the sphere of the secular world, the way money works today. If people can use that wisely, how much more should we then use our other resources wisely towards eternity?
Yeah, like our talents.
Everything we have. And all of us sitting in this room, I mean, I see people in jackets and sweaters. I assume you slept in a house last night. Anyone not? So, from my perspective, we're all rich. So we all have resources at our disposal. We might even have health. We might even have time. We may even have energy.
This says, it's interesting, it says when it fails. It doesn't say if the wealth of the world will fail.
Uh-huh.
It says when it fails. So it's basically saying it will fail.
And there's a minority textual variant there that when you fail, which could mean when you die. Some people, I think the New King James Version translates when you die, then you will have be welcomed. There's this paralleling because the unjust steward is welcomed by these new friends he's made. And the parallel is what we do now with our resources affects how we are welcomed into eternity. I think that's the parallel here.
Don't you think there's always going to be a shade of mystery on some of these parables?
There is a shade of mystery. There's a shade. The shock factor, I think, is what makes you think about, like, oh, that's shocking. Just like other stories, Jesus compared an unjust judge to God, basically. Not a direct comparison, but if an unjust judge will eventually do it, how much more will God do it? And so he's doing the same kind of thing here. If secular people know how to make friends with money, how much more should you believers in Jesus, who, quote, don't care about money. How much more should you know how to use it to make friends? If they can do it, you should be doing it even more so. And so it's interesting if you look at it in that light, because he says, notice when he says, the sons of light, where is that? Later on down.
The children of this world. In 8, the children of this world.
It's the verse 8. The last.
Verse 9.
Verse 8.
Mm-hmm. Oh. The people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their contemporaries than the people of light.
That is verse 8.
And it says, the people of this age, or the people of this generation. And I was reading, there's a Jewish scholar who studied a lot first century Judaisms and the cultural background. Like, you have different streams. You have the what later became the rabbis, rabbinic literature, which started out kind of Pharisaic. You have Essenes. Everyone heard of the Essenes? Mm-hmm. What are they known for?
Dead Sea Scrolls.
Dead Sea Scrolls. Where do they live?
Dead
Qumran.
Why do they live in Qumran?
Stay away.
Because they want to be pure, right? And everybody's messed up. The temple, they've got the wrong dates. They've got the wrong cleanliness rules. So we're the pure. We're going to...
We're the sons of light.
That's right. We're going to separate ourselves. Not have anything to do with them.
They're the sons of darkness.
And we set up our own rules. And they're also kind of... they pooled their wealth together. But... So this Shmuel Safrai suggests that Jesus is actually making a critique here of the Essenes. Saying the people of this generation would be more the average, or the, let's say, I don't want to use the word mainstream, but the Pharisaic, rabbinic, what he sees going on, they're the ones that are using money better than the sons of light, where they're basically just isolationists. I'm not going to touch it. Kind of reminded of the burying your talent in the sand. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not even going to use it. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting take on it, because...
Do you know that in regards to them, or did Jesus not use this phrase in different contexts?
The sons of light?
Yeah.
I don't know how many times he uses the sons of light.
It's not very often.
It's not his average phrase. Mm-hmm. And it's not that we can't be the sons of light, too. I mean, I think Paul uses it.
Yeah.
You know, the light and darkness are metaphors we can all use, but it is interesting that the Essenes were using that as a self-designation.
Yeah.
And so for us today, as followers of Jesus, the question is, how are we using our money? It does matter. And here, in this strange story, we have someone who's willing... Like, the paradigm shift was, oh, I see what's going to happen so clearly that I'm willing to forfeit what would have been / should have been mine according to secular standards. And I'm going to use it instead for getting friends. So now apply this to the kingdom of heaven. So because money means less to me, but I know it means something in this world, I then can use it. I can use my money to make friends and to bring people closer to understanding God. And it is not the same attitude as saying money is evil, or I just need nothing to do with it, and therefore I'm just kind of...
Off to the monastery.
Yeah, I kind of need it. Yeah, I'll pay my rent, whatever, but I won't have anything to do with it. I won't think about it. It's actually using it, using that money, but with a different strategy than everybody else is using, where it's not just, how do I make sure I have a retirement fund? How do I make sure my kids are going to go to college? It's, how do I make sure that God's kingdom is happening here on earth with my money? And so, you have a comment.
You had mentioned that the Essenes, if that's who it is, had combined their monies together, which is similar to what they did in the book of Acts, where they put all their monies together.
Right.
But the opposite of that is mentioned in the Proverbs, when you have a group that is wicked, that is taking from the poor, and they're asking others to combine with them, come with us, and we'll put all of our monies together, and we'll have all together, and we'll be one-on-one, whatever, everybody gets the same thing, and we will take and become very wealthy and prosperous. Because their point, the wicked's point in doing it, is like a commune and it goes bad.
Yeah.
Where they're actually wanting to take.
Well, it's very rare that a commune goes good. Because people's nature eventually becomes selfish. I mean, how many action movies or that type of movie have you seen where there's a group of robbers or a group of, I don't know what, where they're going to split money, and then in the end what happens? They finally get the money and one shoots the other person.
Well, that's
because they want it all, right?
That's the anthropological study of groups and how they are able to...
Sure. Eventually, even when you're a group and everybody gets equal, it breaks down. But that's not necessarily a bad thing, to pool money. I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
And you kill the other people.
Killing other people is a bad thing.
That's a bad thing.
That can be sure about.
It's important in the context of 14 verse when he's saying about greedy Pharisees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the other sphere she talked about. That's the opposite sphere.
Okay, and so I would say anytime you read something that's directed to the Pharisees, put yourself right there. Most people love money in the sense that, you know, we all claim we don't. But if someone just comes up to you straight up and says, sell half your stuff, would you do it? I mean, you could say you have nothing, but literally right now, if you have two pairs of shoes, get rid of one. If you have 10 outfits, get rid of 5, you know? If you have a car, sell it and take half the money and buy a motorbike or bicycle. I don't know what you could even afford here. But how many of us would really do that right now? And then tell me you don't love money. I mean, it's very easy to, you know, put them on the Pharisees, but the Pharisees are just kind of normal people who live in this world. And the problem is that they're not looking past the world. They're looking right here, right now, where it all makes sense. Why wouldn't you want, you know, however many outfits you can get or a car makes things more convenient? And look at Jesus' answer to the Pharisees. You are the ones who justify yourselves in men's eyes. So according to current standards, you're justified. You haven't overstepped your limits. I'm just a normal person. I just have to pay my rent. I just have a, you know, average salary, whatever. But God knows your hearts. And that's the subtlety. God is the one judging, and He sees whether or not you place your importance or your security on your stuff. So in the end, we can't just look at somebody and know from the outside based on how much they have, but God will know.
The word is hypocrisy. Does that really mean money, or is it more...
Possessions.
So
it means possessions.
So that's kind of different. Like the translations that have money, because money seems to be more...
Yeah, we all think of cash.
Cash. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, if you have a jacket and you're cold, that's still a possession, but it keeps you...
Yeah, I think possession is better. Because it's not about money in the end. It's what money does for you. It could be... It can represent land, security, rent. It's all part of...
Featured children.
Yeah, it's all part of possessions or potential possessions you could have, symbolized in the money.
Can I mention another thing?
Yeah.
When Jesus was dealing with the man that had done every possible thing correctly, he had kept all the laws. And Jesus quoted to him a portion of the Ten Commandments. And he said, I didn't. I've done all of these since I was a small child. And he said, what more can I do? Well, then Jesus is now going to get to what's actually in his heart, whether he's willing to serve his own will or the will of God. And that means for that particular man, he has to give up everything that he owns and give it away to the poor.
And I think it is, like in the first century, there were people who followed around rabbis. And there are many stories about how if you see like a rabbi or your father under a burden, you should help your rabbi first. So there's this idea of the priority goes to your teacher because they're the ones helping you understand God's word. And it should be that important to you. And so if Jesus is saying, come follow me, if I'm going to be your teacher, you have to forsake everything else. You have to, quote, hate or prefer less. Basically, I have to be your number one priority. And so, in this case, he's asking that person to give half their possessions away and then come follow me.
All of their possessions.
Was it all?
It was all.
Okay, the other one was half. And come follow me. And the guy says, you know,
the rich young ruler.
I'm not ready to do that.
So. He wasn't ready, and so... Jesus laid it on the line. In other words, this is not about serving people. And it's not about being in a place where you are nicely taken care of.
So,
I always imagined that was Paul.
So here's the thing for us. I don't think we are all asked to sell all our possessions. Like this guy, if he made this a habit every time he gave away his commission, he would be begging on the street because he would have no money at some point. And then things would go right.
But we have to remember that wasn't his master anymore.
Well, true. I mean, it was a temporary fix. This decision was a temporary thing. But it's the attitude behind it. It's the paradigm of, I'm going to look out for a greater cause first, and I'm going to ignore my own needs. That paradigm can be translated. And if you think about it, like often I have these two little kids, one's a 6-year-old, one's a 2.5-year-old, and they like to fight over toys, right? And the older one probably got most of the toys first, and now we have a younger one, so he shares in the toys. Anyway, so the older one will say, well, that's mine. And I think to myself, yeah, it's yours. But it's really mine. I'm the one that paid for it, you know? And so you need to share with your brother because I gave that to you. Like if your brother had been there too, I would have given it to him. It's not... Okay, some things are special. They're birthday presents, like specifically yours. But many of the toys, they're yours and yet they're mine. And so I'm telling you to share it. And I think that's the same thing. Everything we have is really God's. We are the steward. We're simply dispatching resources. And so if you have that perspective, it's not like we're giving away our money. We're just in charge of God's money that has been appointed to us. So how are we
managing
it? How are we managing our time? How are we managing whatever gift you have? Let's say you're good in logistics. How are you using that for the kingdom of God? Let's say you're intelligent. How are you using it? Let's say you have money. How are you using it? You know, it's all of that. It's the whole mindset behind it, I think, that speaks to me. If you view it as, it's not really mine. I'm just managing it, and I will be held accountable for how I do that.
Ultimately, our lives, we don't know if we'll die tomorrow.
True.
Or how long we have left to live, and how do we manage our lives with knowing that it's short, it's not very long
in
the big picture.
It's like if a doctor tells you you have terminal cancer.
You live differently.
And can you take that same principle and try to make each day count in the same way, even if a doctor hasn't told you you have terminal cancer? That's the challenge here.
Sure. I woke up today with Psalm 100. It's for a friend who has a little Down syndrome baby, and I felt the Lord. I gave it to them. It says, know that the Lord is God. It is He who made us, and we are His. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of our home, like you say, our whole life.
Yeah.
Is His.
Right. Right.
Even for the disciple that Jesus said he had to give it all, he wasn't telling the man he would have nothing. Mm-hmm. Because he was asking him to come and live in a lifestyle that was going to be prepared for him. Mm-hmm. He was going to live a totally different type of life.
Right.
He was going to give up the lifestyle he was living and live a different lifestyle. He was going to be provided for.
Right.
He wasn't because Jesus had great provisions, because he had a great following.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't, he was giving up.
And
he was just going to change his lifestyle, and he wasn't willing to do that.
In
maybe he knew he'd end up a martyr if he was a disciple.
I don't think so.
No.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I mean, in Jesus' day, rabbis were supported by the community. If you're a traveling teacher, you could expect someone to offer for you to stay in their house, and they would give you your meals. And so you would be taken care of. You just had to keep teaching. And so, yeah, he would be taken care of. It just would be not in the way maybe he wanted. He may not get to choose an Apple computer, you know, and he wouldn't be in control of it. So it's still not an easy decision.
The neat thing is that people are called to have different lifestyles, so we just mm-hmm. accept the one we're supposed to have. There are people who are supposed to be rich and have lots to mm-hmm. do. And
that's true.
To serve God.
And that, again, that's why I'm saying it's not like a formula, like now we all need to go out and get rid of half of everything we own. But we do have to have the attitude of, it's not really mine. And how honest are we in applying that attitude? Like, do we really have that attitude about our clothes and our computers and our cars? I don't know what other things.
And our language and our time.
Our time.
How about our reputation?
Like, it's so easy to compare yourself to the person just above you or on your level, and never to the person just underneath you. Because growing up, I had some friends that I would call rich. And as a kid, as a 9-year-old, I did call my friend rich. And she was just like, I'm not rich. And she went back and talked to her mom about it. And she came back, she said, we're not rich, we're well off. I said, oh. Okay. But the truth is, she's probably, in her community, she's average. So we all just think we're average in our community. The problem is, you know, there's so many people beneath us, and we only see our average and the people just above us. I have a relative the same way. You know, she lives in Southern California, and her house is over $1 million worth. She probably doesn't think she's rich either. And you know what? To upkeep that kind of lifestyle, she has to use all the money she has. She has to hire gardeners and pool men and someone to clean the palace she lives in. You know, it's true. And she probably feels pinched financially.
Yeah.
But it's all your perspective. And is she looking at the people underneath her, or is she looking at the people in Hollywood who own the $5 million ranch down the road, you know, just a level above? And, you know, I'm not rich, they are. And so that's what strikes me about this, just, you know, that having that perspective for where you are and comparing yourself to the world. We're all rich. Clearly. There's, you know, if you were wondering about it, I'll just tell you straightforward right now. If you're in this room right now, you're rich.
I was just looking at the next two verses, 14 and 15, and I think they kind of put a little perspective on what we just read. And Mm-hmm. Now the Pharisees were lovers of money, were listening to all these things and were scoffing at him. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves in the sight of men, but God knows your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is detestable in the sight of God."
Mm-hmm.
So, I told you these things, but you know.
Yeah.
What you
value.
What Elizabeth Elliot said after her husband had died, "He who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose is no fool."
That's right.
Yeah, so you can't. And he already said you are gonna lose this.
Yeah.
Anyway, so.
Yeah. And you can do better work. If you've seen The Band of Brothers, it's a documentary on
World War II.
And they keep making, I think they make it more than once, this comment that the only way to survive is basically to tell yourself you're already dead.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you can completely give up on yourself, which again, like give up your own commission, you will do more good and be able to save more people than if you're constantly in fear for your own life and you're just like hiding, terrorized in your little, you know, dugout.
Foxhole.
Yeah. So, so we got to go downstairs for the worship service now. But keep in mind, in your situation, how you can be wise with your resources.